Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. The weather is warmer, and for many Americans, that means it's time to break out their binoculars, hit the trail, and look up at the sky. This is the life of a birder who is more excited about spotting a ruby-throated hummingbird than an A-list celebrity. We heard about the history of this increasingly popular American pastime when naturalist Scott Wiedenthal joined us on Radio Times back in 2007. He chronicled the evolution of birding in his book, Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. Let's take a listen. Well, let's roll back the clock a couple of centuries, and you describe, of course, the first, as you write in the book, ornithologists were the American Indians who were here when Europeans arrived. But you describe, or they described, the European settlers who came here in the 1600s, that, not surprisingly, the sky is just teeming with birds, and I'm assuming birds that they had never seen in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that struck them was the numbers of birds, the diversity of birds, and also how colorful American birds were in comparison to those in Northern and Western Europe. You know, we have a there's a group of Old World birds known as Old World warblers, and they are as alike as photocopies. They're lovely birds in a subtle way, but they're mostly drab ochres and browns, and you line them all up, and you have a hard time picking one from the other. And you come to North America, where we have an unrelated group of birds, also known as warblers, that are all the colors of the rainbow. Prothonotary warblers that are brilliant yellow, Perula warblers with this brilliant orange patch across the face, you know, Blackburnian warblers that look like a tiger, you know, this brilliant orange and black. They look like they'd set the trees on fire. And so they were just, these early Europeans were just gobsmacked by these birds. And you mentioned the sheer numbers of them.
Yeah.
I mean, William Penn wrote about the incredible numbers of waterfowl that came pouring down the Delaware River every fall, many, many observers talking about the extraordinary numbers of passenger pigeons, which, of course, today are completely extinct.
Well, and I guess part, not surprisingly, part of this world, I guess, of naturalists and ornithologists, they shot and collected a lot of birds. I mean, I guess this, before you could look at them through your binoculars, that was one way of looking at them, which was what, I guess, to shoot them and hold them in your hand?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's something that modern birders, I think, are somewhat aghast at, which is really kind of silly. I mean, think about it. One of the first naturalists exploring a, to your society, unknown land and seeing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of varieties of birds, and you have no binoculars, you have no cameras, you know, there's no optics at all. The only way to start to understand them is to shoot the bird, collect it, make a specimen skin of it so you have it available for study, to paint it, to measure it. You know, so for the first several hundred years, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Brief History of American Birding. I warned my editor, you know, nobody picks up a pair of binoculars until two-thirds of the way through the book. Before that, it's all shotguns, because it had to be.
There are some names in here I recognize in your book. Audubon, of course, John and William Bartram. But there's some people in here, frankly, I hadn't heard of. A woman named Martha Maxwell, who was a collector, and she mounted specimens. You have a photograph in this book of some specimens that she mounted, this amazing diorama of species.
Yeah, in fact, she's the woman who invented the museum diorama, which is something she doesn't get credit for. She was born in Pennsylvania in the 1830s and moved as a young girl to Wisconsin, married a somewhat older man who lost everything in a financial panic, and so they ended up moving to Colorado in, I believe, 1860. He was going to become a gold miner and make his fortune, and he didn't. He was a very bad gold miner. She basically kept them afloat by running a boarding house and by starting to do taxidermy. And by 1876, when they had the big centennial exposition here in Philadelphia, Colorado's territorial exhibition was Martha Maxwell's, as you said, this enormously complex diorama of, you know, full-size mounted elk and mule deer and leaping cougars and many, many dozens of species of birds with flowing streams through the middle of it. She was also in touch with many of the prominent ornithologists of the day, collecting birds scientifically for them. And in fact, to this day, one of the subspecies of the eastern screech owl is still named Maxwell Screech Owl because she's the one who first collected it.
Another person, and Elliot Cowes, who was there are many eccentrics who are part of this history that we're talking about. He's clearly one of them.
Yes, and in
Scott,
fact, Cowes was actually one of Maxwell's mentors. Cowes was, as many of the 19th century ornithologist. He was an army officer because you could collect safely from the confines of a fort. He was an idiosyncratic.
Does it probably help deal with boredom? I would think too.
Exactly. You know, you're stuck out there. You're either being attacked by Indians, or you're trying to pass the time. And so many army officers, particularly medical officers, became collectors for Spencer Fullerton Baird, who was the secretary of the Smithsonian and the founder of the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. So yes, you had Cowes, who was wonderfully contradictory. He had a, shall we say, a difficult relationship with women, including his three wives.
Yes.
And he was a flagrant womanizer and something of a misogynist. And yet he also was an early proponent for women's rights, lost his teaching job at what later became Columbia University because of that, was as I said, an early advocate for women ornithologists like Martha Maxwell, people like Mabel Osgood Wright, who was one of the founders of the modern Audubon movement. As I said to you just a moment ago, there were a lot of layers to the onion that was Elliot Cowes.
he talked about opera glass fiends.
Oh yes,
who was he referring to?
Well, he was talking about the Audubonians, as he put it. He helped many of the women who founded the modern Audubon movement, but he had a great disdain for people who only wanted to watch birds. To Cowes, ornithological wisdom flowed from the muzzle of a shotgun, and in one of his last books, he was giving young ornithologists direction on how to build their collection. And he said, he rhetorically asked the question, well, how many birds should you collect? And he said, as many as you can shoot. Wow. A good day would be 50 birds shot, stuffed, and all the data recorded, that you should have, multiple specimens from multiple species. And this was at a time when the balance was starting to shift toward birding as a hobby rather than ornithology as a science. And more people were aghast at the idea of just anybody going out with a shotgun and killing hundreds of birds for their own personal collection.
I guess then, because of the bird decline, what you see then is the rise of things like the ornithological societies, or specifically, I guess, the Audubon Society.
That's right. And actually, there were two Audubon societies. Interestingly, the first was founded in 1886 by a man serendipitously named George Bird Grinnell, who had been a student of John James Audubon's widow Lucy when he was a young man. He was a prominent conservationist, and he created the first Audubon Society specifically to try to stop the feather trade, and it failed. And so he kind of, took his ball and went home. And about 10 years later, women in Boston, particularly a woman named Harriet Hemingway, who sat at the absolute apex of Boston society, created the second Audubon movement. And they were able to tap into this women's club movement that had gained strength in the late 1800s, women fighting for universal suffrage, fighting against poverty, fighting for temperance. And they were able to say to these women, look, if you're going to wear the feathers of these innocent birds on your head, you're robbing yourself of the moral high ground. And within a very short time, they created this robust Audubon Society that remains today, and also held the feet of legislators to the fire and created many of the landmark bird protection laws that remain on the books today, like the Migratory Bird Protection Act in 1814, which remains the sort of the bedrock protection for most wild birds.
Let me put out another name. Florence Merriam wrote a book called Birds Through an Opera Glass, I guess, speaking of opera glasses, right? And this was the first field guide.
You could make an argument that it was. Florence Merriam came out with this book in the 1880s. She was a recent college graduate, quite a young woman, was writing articles for Bird Lore magazine about birding. And this was the first time that somebody had written a book that was dedicated to the idea of helping people, the average person, not a scientist, the average person, identify live birds in the field using, well, they're not really binoculars because, opera glasses leave a lot to be desired.
Yes, but
it was the first time somebody wrote a book that wasn't predicated on the idea of having a dead bird in the hand to identify first. Now, it was a long time before we finally got the first fully functional, usable field guide in 1934 when Roger Torrey Peterson published his. But Merriam's was one of those early progenitors of the modern field guide.
And I guess binoculars have transformed bird watching.
Oh, God, yes. Even through about World War II, it was difficult to get a good pair of binoculars at a reasonable price. Most of them were made in Europe. But after World War II, the market was flooded with relatively inexpensive binoculars. It became easier to move around the country. And that combination of better optics and better mobility and also having a good field guide so you could identify what you're seeing.
Do you have your list of birds that you've seen?
I keep a life list, yeah. I couldn't tell you probably within 75 or 100 species how many are on there. Some birders are very focused on their list.
Yes, they
are. It becomes very competitive.
Yes, they are.
They're competitive against each other. They're competitive against themselves. There's nothing wrong with that. What worries me, and this is something I talk about in the book and have been beaten up a little bit for by some of my birding friends, is I think sometimes that modern birding is too list focused. We're too focused on birds as inventory, that it's just another tick mark on your life list, and once you've seen it, it doesn't matter anymore.
Then you're on to your next bird,
and then you're on to the next one. And I love going to a new area where I haven't seen birds. I love the thrill of particularly finding it on my own. I love the thrill of finding a bird that's way out of range. I walked out of my house one day a few years ago and found a white-winged dove from the southwest sitting on the telephone wire. But birding today has become so focused on rarities and building up a big list that I think some birders, by no means all, but some birders have lost the sight of the bigger picture, which is the bird itself.
Well, in fact, you say the birders need to do more to think about conservation, I guess, and habitat conservation and preserving the environment for birds.
And I think you'll rarely find another group of people that are as ecologically literate as birders. They understand the issues. What I'm saying is that we need to mobilize and we need more activism. You know, I've been a hunter and an angler all my life, and sportsmen have had it drummed into their head from birth that conservation is expensive, and you have to pay for conservation. And they do. And so they have self-imposed excise taxes on fishing tackle and sporting arms and ammunition, and all that money goes back into wildlife conservation at the state level. Attempts to try to get birders to do the same thing have really failed.
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, part of it is there's been a tremendous amount of opposition from the retail end of things, you know, the L.L. Beans of the world who don't want to add 10 or 12% to the cost of a pair of binoculars or a backpack or a field guide or a pound of bird seed. But if there are 81 million people in America who care about birds, as we are told, and even a tenth of them picked up the phone and called their congressman, we'd have this passed tomorrow. Hmm. You know, the only way we are going to have birds to enjoy in the future is to stand up right now and become active.
Do what anglers and hunters have done, you're
absolutely
saying.
Absolutely. My good friend Ken Kaufman, who's one of the top birders in the world today, a man for whom I have a great deal of respect, has said only partially with tongue-in-cheek that maybe the way to approach this is that you shouldn't be able to count a bird on your life list until you have done something concrete to help that species, whether it's making a donation or writing a letter or just doing something. And in that way, connect the sport of bird watching, the sport of birding and listing with the conservation of birds. I'm not trying to make a blanket statement. There are many birders who are doing wonderful things for bird conservation, but it needs to become more of a universal ethos.
That was my 2007 conversation with naturalist and author Scott Wiedenthal about his book Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. If you want more information about birding, you can visit the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club website at dvoc.org. When we get back, we'll talk about getting dirty in the dirt with evolutionary biologist and behavioral ecologist Marlene Zook, author of a book called Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Stay with us.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring.
This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're celebrating the arrival of spring in this hour of Radio Times, and what says spring more than mating? And since the last segment was all about observing birds, let's move on to the bees. We talked about the mating patterns of bugs when Marlene Zook, professor of biology at the University of Minnesota's College of Biological Sciences, joined us in 2011. We talked about her book, Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Let's listen. Well, let's talk about sex on six legs. And I do want to get to the parenting part and the communication part as well. But obviously, that's the title of your book. And, you know, bugs wouldn't be here if it weren't for reproduction. But there are some, I would say, dramatic descriptions of some of the mating of insects. And you write about and include descriptions of dung flies. And I know you've been asked about this because it is pretty dramatic. But talk about, I guess, how those mating rituals take place.
Sure. So in dung flies, as in lots of other animals, males are fighting with each other to get access to females. And what that'll mean is, you know, and I realize that standing around watching cattle dung is not what most people think of when they want to, you know, go for a racy time, but you'd be surprised.
Exactly.
And in fact, what happens is that the males will grapple with each other trying to get to a female. The female has to lay her eggs on the dung, and they'll form these great big, you know, golden balls of fly, because the color of the exoskeleton on the fly and the hairs on the fly is yellow. And so they'll form these great big golden balls as the males are fighting with each other. But what's even more dramatic, and what insects have taught us as well, is that even the violence that happens before sex isn't the end of things. After mating happens, in many, many insects, if females mate with more than one male, which they often do, the sperm from those males actually competes inside the body of the female.
Wow.
So that it can end up fertilizing the eggs. And so that tells us a lot of really interesting things. First of all, it tells us that this old-fashioned idea that females are always going to be monogamous because it's, you know, better for them, and that they're not going to benefit by mating with multiple males, well, that turns out not to be true. But more important, okay, even if you want to try and anthropomorphize insects and say, oh, yes, they want to do this, they're trying to do that, nobody in their right mind is going to say that sperm cells are trying to do anything. They can't possibly have any conscious awareness of what's happening. And so it really shows you what evolution can do without having to have a conscious need or a conscious effort or a thought process that's going on. So the sperm are competing, but obviously they're not thinking about it.
Well, and competing so that the biggest one wins, so to speak?
Well, the one that wins, wins. It's not necessarily the biggest one. It's just that different sperm, they'll swim at different speeds. They'll have a larger percentage, a given male will have a larger percentage of his sperm that can manage to survive longer in the reproductive tract of the female, whatever it takes. So there'll be competition that happens between males after mating is over and after you think, oh, well, that's done with, you know, we've figured it all out. So insects have really shown us that you can get competition between not just the males themselves, mm-hmm. but actually between their sperm.
And I guess that this is survival of the fittest at work?
Of course. Well, I mean, as is everything else. So in other words, you have selection happening so that the males that are most successful are the ones that are most likely to pass on their genes. And so they're passing on the genes that have whatever qualities allowed them to become more successful, sure.
You also have a description of the penis of a male damselfly. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Although, you know, let us pause, Marty, for a moment and think that, you know, like, it's not often that on national radio you get, you know, tell us about the penis of male damselflies. But and actually, if I want to be really pedantic, it's not really called a penis. It's called an aegis if someone really wants like a new nerd term. but in any event, what happens is that when damselflies mate, the male puts his intromittent organ inside the female. And it's got like a little shovel-like thing on it. Some species have a shovel combined with little spines and stickers and stuff like that. And all of that is used to scoop out the sperm of the preceding male before depositing his own. So it's like he kind of clears the way for his own genes to get in.
Let me go back to some of the things that you write about in your book. And one is the sex ratio between men and women, which is generally around 50-50. As we look at the insect world, does that help explain this relatively balanced ratio?
Again, one of the things I like about insects is that they show us that things do not always have to be the way they are in people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've grown up thinking, well, of course you have to have a relatively even sex ratio because everybody's going to have one mate, and then that way we're going to be able to reproduce and everything will work out fine. But it turns out that in at least some insects, there's wildly skewed sex ratios, usually very, very female bias. So there's lots and lots of females for every male that's produced. And it'll happen in a variety of very special circumstances, like social insects, like honeybees and ants and wasps usually have way more females than males, and they'll only produce enough males to fertilize females that are going to then go and found new colonies of their own. So male bees, which are the drones, are just, they're just a few of them produced. They kind of hang around the honeybee hive, being fed by their sisters and loafing. They are not the bees you see flying from flower to flower. They don't work. And then when the time is right, they'll leave the hive, attempt to fertilize a queen. If they succeed in doing that, then she'll have enough sperm inside of her body to last for up to several years. And they're gone, dead, you know, never to be seen again. So there's not really any function for having an even sex ratio because the males don't do anything but fertilize a female who's then going to produce a lot more females.
My memory as a kid growing up actually in Massachusetts, and our wet bathing suits would be hanging on the line and we would get into them and they were filled with what we thought were earwigs and they would bite us.
Filled with earwigs.
Well, maybe
I'm envisioning filled with earwigs.
All right, I'll take that back. Several, maybe one or two earwigs.
Okay. let's be really direct here.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair
you
enough.
Found an earwig in your bathing
there
suit
you
once. Okay. Yeah. obviously if they're, you know, about to be smashed or, you know, if it looks like they're, you know, going to be hurt, then yes, they can pinch you with the cerci on the back of the abdomen. So they're not biting you really. They're pinching you with the cerci on the back of the abdomen. But it's, you know, it's not like they're going to run up to you out of, you know, the clear blue sky and just start, you know, attacking people. I know no one really. And notice there are no movies called Attack of the Killer Earwigs.
No, I did notice that. But talk about earwigs as parents or as mothers. What makes them such good mothers?
So you think that mostly insects are going to just lay eggs and leave them and go away and die, which is really true for most insects. But some of them are excellent parents. And again, it's an example of how they're great at doing things that are required for survival and reproduction. And for a lot of insects, the problem is if you lay your eggs and leave them, then some other insect or other animal will come along and eat them or destroy them. So for many insects, they're going to ensure their reproductive success by taking care of those eggs until they're old enough to take care of themselves. And earwig mothers will clean the eggs after the mothers laid them, keep fungus off them, protect them from other predators. And then once the eggs hatch into little tiny miniature earwigs, which are very cute. I mean, they really are very cute.
I believe it.
Then she goes off and finds little tiny prey to bring back to feed them. So she feeds them just like a bird feeds her nestlings.
But you also write, and I found this absolutely fascinating, the emerald cockroach wasp actually doesn't actually kill a cockroach to bring back for the baby wasps, but as you write, turns them into a zombie and then brings them back for food. Help us understand that process and I guess what's at work here.
So in several types of insect parasites, they're doing exactly what you said. They're feeding their babies, in effect, preserved insect flesh. So, you know, a big problem if you want to bring food home and you don't have a refrigerator is how to keep it fresh. Well, we've solved that by inventing refrigerators. Insects have solved that by transforming the food they eat into kind of living, preserved, food objects so that the prey that they bring back is paralyzed so that it can't get away, but it's not dead so it doesn't start to decompose.
Wow.
And there's lots of wasps that do this where, for instance, they'll fly off, find a caterpillar, sting it in a particular part of the nervous system so that it's immobile, but it's still alive, and then put it in the nest. It stays kind of preserved until the babies hatch. In the jewel wasp, it's even more dramatic because what they do is find a cockroach, they'll sting it, and it can still move, but it can't really do very much. And so in effect, this has been described not by me, but by some of the people who've worked on it, as picking up the antenna of the cockroach and using it to lead the cockroach along like you're leading a dog on a leash, taking it back to the nest, and then sort of leaving it there for the babies to eat. So it's a different and perhaps arguably more gruesome way of preserving your food.
But at the same time, then they don't have to carry, right? They don't have to carry
exactly.
this cockroach,
yeah,
but
they
a sense of, you know, and this is to, I'm quoting here, have sort of hypnotized them perhaps and then led them back to be feasted upon.
Yes. And so again, what this, I mean, other than just being a like really great gory story to tell people, if you ever run out of other things to tell people, it's also a really interesting illustration of, well, so how does the nervous system do that? You know, could we learn something from this about anesthesia? Could we learn something about this, just about how brain cells work, about how nerve cells work? It's a real, seeing how different other organisms can be really helps us understand what the limitations might or might not be in our own systems.
Let me quote again from your book, and this is actually you quoting Aristotle, but it has to do with parenting. And Aristotle said, mothers are fonder than fathers of their children because they are more certain they are their own. And you talk about this thing called the confidence of paternity, the idea that a mother knows who the father is, but the father might not know he's the father or not. How does this then express itself in the insect world?
What it means is that male care of offspring is going to be much rarer than female care. And that's true all over the animal kingdom. It's not just in insects. And if you think about it, that makes sense. So selection's only going to work on a characteristic if it makes you do something that will allow you to reproduce more. But taking care of somebody else's genes, in effect, isn't really going to do you any good at all. Well, with a male, if he's mated with a female and another male's mated with that female, some of the offspring might be his and some of the offspring might be the other male's. So taking care of all of them might mean that he's wasting his effort from an evolutionary perspective. What that means for insects is that some of the time you'll see male-only parental care, but it'll happen only in a very particular set of circumstances. So, for instance, with giant water bugs. Giant water bugs are, as the name implies, you know, great big bugs that live in the water there in streams and other parts of fresh water in the Southwest. And the females will come up to a male, and she'll put her eggs on the male's back. So they're sort of, it looks kind of like, his back looks like a big giant egg carton with lots and lots of little eggs on it. But the female lays her eggs on there before the male uses his sperm to fertilize them. So she can't put eggs that have been fertilized by another male on his back. He then carries the fertilized eggs around and protects them and sometimes even takes care of them after they hatch. But you're only going to see that in a situation where he has complete confidence of paternity. In other words, all of the eggs are absolutely genetically his.
I guess others like yourself have tried to take a look at whether bugs have personalities, and this feels a bit on thin ice. But how do you, I guess, wrestle with that idea, that notion? Or do you?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. And insects are the classic kind of robot organisms. I think part of why people are scared of them is that they just seem so unfeeling and unthinking, and they're just like advancing on you, again, like something out of a science fiction movie. And in part, it's like that because they don't spend a lot of their time learning. They don't seem to respond as much to their environment as, say, a puppy does, or, you know, some other animal that we're more comfortable with calling, with having a personality. But in fact, insects do take a lot in from their environment, and they do have what people are increasingly starting to call personality. Hmm. If you think about it, all a personality means is that the way you are under some circumstances is the way you are under other circumstances. So people that are aggressive, maybe on, you know, in sports, might also be aggressive in their job if they're, you know, a stockbroker or something like that. And so it all carries over. Well, it turns out that in insects, you get some of that carrying over of traits also. And in some animals, in some insects, if they are more likely to come out of their hiding place after they've been scared by a predator, they're also going to be more likely to be in combat with other individuals, like other males, for access to a female. And so it's like they've just got these suites of characteristics that all occur together. People tend to call that, they don't tend to call it personality, or at least sometimes they don't call it personality, they'll call it a behavioral syndrome. But It's really kind of the same thing, that insects will have these tendencies to act the same way, just like people will have these tendencies to act the same way under different sets of circumstances.
But I guess the difference is that we think of people, although there are many things we share, is that people have an individual has an individual personality. You can't say that about an insect, can you?
I'm kind of on the fence about that one, because I always worry that people are going to make them too much like people. People are going to make insects too much like people when they're really not. But at the same time, the more we look, the more differences and the more variation that we see. So really, they're not all automatons and they're not all alike. If they were exactly alike, then evolution wouldn't, you know, have any way to act on them. And we know that they're still evolving.
They don't have feelings, though, do they?
I'm not going to touch that one. But, okay. You know, see, again, I don't know. So what does have feelings? People are pretty comfortable saying that, oh, their pets have feelings. Everybody thinks their pets have feelings. But, you know, that's kind of hard to define. Do you know what's going on in there? Is it really the same thing that's going on inside of you? Mm-hmm. I think insects are a really good way to start thinking about that. That, all right, if we're comfortable saying that apes have feelings and that dogs and cats have feelings, how about your goldfish? You think your goldfish has feelings? Most people would be kind of on the fence about that one. All right, what about frogs? Do frogs have feelings? Well, they seem like they... But one of the things I like about insects is they make you ask questions like that, and you start thinking, well, where do I draw the line? Everything isn't like people.
And get you to think about the kind of projections that we put on the world, right? Especially the animals that we live with. So what do you love about crickets?
So some of it, of course, is just the familiarity that I've been studying them for a long time, and they always have something new to show me. And part of it is that, as our listener who liked the katydids mentioned before, it's just beautiful listening to their songs. I think they're very evocative of summer. And some of it is that, from the standpoint of being a scientist, they're so cool to study, and they've got all this amazing behavior. I think they've just been really... really fun for me to work on. I will say I'm on the fence. They're not, in terms of genuine beauty, they're certainly not as gorgeous as, say, butterflies or, you know, something like that. But I don't know. I just have a real affection for them.
and we're almost out of time here. I know another interest of yours is parasites. And that's such a fascinating relationship, I guess, between the parasitic relationship between insects. Is that in part what drew you to parasites?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the parasites that I study, again, similar to the emerald wasps that we talked about before and the sort of suspended animation that some insects can do, this idea that you can have insects parasitizing other insects living off of their body tissue while they're still alive is just like the movie Alien, only in real life, which is really what a lot of studying insects is about. It's like, you know, the whole truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes, and that's why boys do it. Bees do it.
Again, that was my 2011 conversation with evolutionary biologist and behavioral ecologist Marlene Zook, author of Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. This is Radio Times in Review. When we get back, we'll continue our nature-themed show with primatologist Franz de Waal. Stay with us.
Upper sense do it. Lithuanians. And let's do it. Let's do it.
Welcome back to the springtime edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been spending the hour revisiting interviews about observing the natural world, and one of the most renowned observers is primatologist and ethologist Franz de Waal. He's authored 14 books in which he details the connections between humans and our evolutionary ancestors, the apes. He joined me in 2013 to discuss the bonobo and the atheist in search of humanism among primates. The book is an examination of morality in the natural world, including theories about how humans have attained and maintained their innate sense of good and evil. Let's take a listen to my conversation with Franz de Waal. Your book is largely about the research on chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest living relatives, but they're different from each other.
These two are very different. So anthropologists have always preferred the chimpanzee to compare us with, because chimpanzees are aggressive and wage war, and the males kill males in other territories, and they have strong hierarchies. And for some reason, this was very popular, because, of course, anthropologists believe that humans advanced as a species by wiping out everybody else. That's actually a problematic proposition, because we now know that humans have 4% DNA of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, which means that instead of wiping out the Neanderthals, we bred with them. And so sex was part of the story. And they tend to forget that, but they don't like the bonobo for the reason that the bonobo is not aggressive, has a lot of sex. And my view is that maybe our history has more bonobo elements than they want to admit, and less chimpanzee elements of violence and so on.
So should we think of bonobos as hippies?
They are sort of the hippies of the primate world because they have female dominance. So they're very popular with the feminist community for that reason. They have lots of sex in all sorts of combinations. So they're very popular with the gay community for that reason. So they are sort of the politically correct primate. But we should not exaggerate because people often think that they have no aggression at all. But the reason they have so much sex is probably partly to keep the aggression under control, and they're very good at it. Yeah.
You've also done some interesting research, I guess, on this notion of fairness. Bonobo Pambanisha. I mean, showed a kind of generosity, I guess, in dealing with treats that she was getting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's purely generosity. What happened in that case, she was being trained for a certain task and getting lots of goodies for it, like M&Ms and raisins and good stuff that bonobos usually don't get. And other bonobos were watching her from a distance that she normally lives with. And at some point, she stopped doing the task and she waved her hand to the others until the others also got some of the goodies, and then she continued. And so, yes, you could look at it as an act of generosity. You could also look at it, well, she might get into trouble later on. If she takes all this good stuff and they get nothing, and then later we reunite the bonobos, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's actually, fairness is an interesting concept because I think fairness is not necessarily regulated by empathy. It's regulated by having good relationships, and if you have a fair distribution, it's easier to maintain them than if you have an unfair distribution.
And because I called it generosity, are there also risks of ascribing certain traits that we would think of as human traits to, in this case, to primates?
I tend to take the position that if an animal is very closely related to us and does similar things under similar circumstances, we have to come up with a similar concept to explain it. So I know that there are psychologists and people who work on animals who are very conservative in their terminology and say we should avoid anthropomorphism, which is fine if you see, for example, fish doing something similar to humans. Yes, there's probably a different explanation for what the fish are doing. But a chimpanzee or bonobo is as close to us genetically as a horse is to a zebra. Now, if a horse and a zebra do similar stuff under similar circumstances, we're certainly going to come up with a similar explanation for it. And I would apply the same rule to human and primate behavior.
One of your greatest hits when it comes to animal behavior, and these are two capuchin monkeys. One is given some cucumber, the other given a grape. And I recommend that people go to our Facebook page and look at it because it's not only very funny, it's very revealing. Tell us what's going on.
The reason we humans find it so funny, because people always laugh, and the clip has been the clip has been advertised as a hilarious experiment. The reason people laugh is because I think it makes them slightly nervous to see that animals have very similar feelings to themselves. So there is an element of nervosity in it, which I don't mind. What we did with the capuchin monkeys is we put them side by side and we have them do the same task, a very simple task. And if you give both monkeys the same reward, let's say you give them both grapes or you give them both cucumber, they're perfectly fine doing it 25 times in a row. Right. But if you do different rewards, one gets grapes, and grapes are much better than cucumber slices. So if you give one of them grapes and the other one cucumber, the one who gets cucumber is very upset about that and gets very agitated and refuses the task and actually starts to refuse the food. Which is an irrational thing, according to economists. You should always take anything you can get, but they start doing that. And so that's a sense of fairness. When we first published that, we got letters from philosophers, because philosophers had written whole books about the sense of justice and the sense of fairness and how we reason ourselves to moral principles and stuff like that. And they couldn't stand the idea that a monkey would have that same sense. Mm. And so we got letters from philosophers who said it's impossible because the sense of fairness was invented during the French Revolution, and so how can monkeys know about this and stuff like that? But now we have gone much further even, because the monkeys have a very egocentric sense of fairness. I mean, they care about getting less than somebody else. But with chimpanzees, we have now the point, which is a bit similar to the Pambanisha story, where chimpanzees will refuse the better reward if the other one doesn't get the better reward also.
So can we say that chimps and bonobos, that they're moral creatures?
I wouldn't call them moral, and I've never called a chimpanzee or bonobo a moral being in the human sense. I think they have a lot of the ingredients that we have built into our moral system, such as caring about others, caring about rules, following rules, punishing those who deviate. All these things can be observed in them, empathy, sense of fairness, and so on. But to have real morality the way we do, there's additional elements. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we reason about and we try to justify why we have certain rules. And we try to seek consistency. We have a discussion about whether if you're for the death penalty, you should be for abortion or the kind of discussions we have. And so that sort of thing, of course, doesn't happen really in chimpanzees mm-hmm. and bonobos. And we also try to objectify these rules. And so the moral rules that we live by, we, for example, I live by, you live by, we feel everyone in the world should live by these rules. And so we think that the rules are universal, and I don't think chimpanzees particularly care about that issue.
At least not yet in their evolution. Yeah. But are you also saying, I mean, there is this, and you write about it in the book, this veneer theory of morality, the idea that underneath us we're just wild, you know, a cauldron of nasty tendencies. I think I'm quoting you there. I mean, that's a view of human nature, is that we're essentially bad. Mm-hmm. And we have this overlay of morality that forces us to be good.
That's a view that was actually popular in biology. It was not a Darwinian view, but during the 70s and 80s and 90s, biologists such as Richard Dawkins and Robert Wright and other people, they started promoting this view that we are inherently selfish and competitive, and there's really no room for moral evolution. Just like Huxley, who was a contemporary of Darwin, who also saw no room for the evolution of morality, the biologists sort of talked us into this corner where, on the one hand, they said evolution cannot explain morality. We don't believe in religion. Well, then there's nothing left. If biology and religion are not there, then I don't know how you would ever explain the reason we have morality. And so Darwin saw this problem, recognized this, and Darwin proposed that evolution can produce these moral tendencies. Now, the veneer theory is basically the idea that we are so 100% selfish that we can never overcome that, maybe only culturally or religiously, and that we naturally don't have any tendency to be good or nice to others. Mm. Now, this whole thing is now sort of forgotten, because after the year 2000, the economists started to find that we are much more cooperative than they thought. Then the neuroscientists found that if we give to charity and do nice things, there's pleasure centers in our brain that light up, meaning that we take pleasure in being nice to other people. Then primatologists such as myself said, well, a lot of our close relatives, they have actually genuine altruism going on. And the anthropologists started playing the ultimatum game all over the world and finding sense of fairness in all people of the world. Around the year 2000, the whole veneer theory collapsed and is now nearly forgotten 10 years later.
But it is also true that there's violence among chimpanzees.
You know, my first book was Chimpanzee Politics, which was all about power struggles and violence and fights and coalitions and stuff like that, very much like Washington, basically. and so I'm very familiar with that. And even though at the moment I often emphasize the nice side, the pro-social, the morality and so on, there would be no reason for morality in human society if we were purely nice. You realize that if we were 100% friendly and nice to each other, there would be absolutely no reason for a system of rules. And so it exists to a large degree because there are conflicts in society.
Your book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist. Mm-hmm. And you have at the very end, essentially, what would a bonobo tell an atheist? Expand on that. I found that an interesting section.
And actually, in that discussion that I put at the end between the bonobo and the atheist, the bonobo grants a lot of ground to the atheist.
He's very nice to the atheist.
Yeah, he's actually very nice to the atheist. And so I don't think atheists should be too upset with my book. But the bonobo basically says, slow down on that question of whether God exists or not. That is not really the interesting question. He says the interesting question is, where does morality come from? And then, of course, the bonobo also explains that we shouldn't look too much at social insects, which has been done so much, but they don't have the empathy mechanism. They have lots of altruism, which is probably achieved in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not denying that they are not they're perfectly cooperative and altruistic, but they don't have that empathy mechanism that makes you respond to the distress of others that all the mammals have. And so that's what the bonobo tries to explain about it.
What would a bonobo say to a fundamentalist? Have you thought about that?
To a biblical literalist, you mean?
Yeah.
He would say, well, close the book for a while and start thinking about the world and look at the evidence, you know.
What got you interested in bonobos? As you said, early on, people were looking at chimp behavior, and bonobos are more, I guess, recent development in the world of research, primate research.
Yeah, so bonobos were discovered much later than chimpanzees, yeah. and they live in pretty inaccessible forests in Central Africa. And so as a result, we know much less about the bonobos. And since they came later, there has been a tendency in anthropology to focus all the attention on the chimpanzee. So when Ardipithecus was discovered, they were making all these comparisons with chimps and say, well, Ardipithecus looked quite different, was a much more peaceful creature because it had small canines. They forgot completely about the bonobo, who, in terms of body proportions, looks exactly like Ardipithecus, has reduced canine teeth, is peaceful. So the anthropologists need to learn how to pay attention to bonobos.
And you can see the physical connection between bonobos and humans.
Yeah, you can see that. And because bonobos have longer legs when they stand upright, and they walk upright quite a bit, actually. So that's another thing, of course, anthropologists long have emphasized how good humans are at walking bipedally, but bonobos are actually quite good at that.
I'm curious about what you see if you go to Central Africa and you see bonobos in their natural habitat and what you see at Yerkes.
Well, it's very hard in the field with bonobos because they live in dense forest and high up in the trees to see all the details of the behavior. And that's why a lot of our studies on bonobos we do in Kinshasa. There's a sanctuary where they receive orphaned bonobos because there's unfortunately a lot of bushmeat trade in Africa. So they shoot the adult bonobos and they try to sell the babies on the market live. And the babies are then confiscated, brought to the sanctuary where they're raised. And we do a lot of studies of consolation in those bonobos. So the consolation is when someone has lost a fight and is screaming, and how others then approach and calm them down and groom them or have sex with them in the case of bonobos. And what we found, one of the things we found is that mother-reared bonobos, because there's quite a few there who are raised there by female bonobos, mother-reared bonobos are far more empathic in this kind of situations than the orphan bonobos. It's very similar to the story on Romanian orphanages, where they study human orphans and find that they are emotionally very disturbed and they don't show a lot of empathy responses. So the same thing we're finding in these bonobo studies.
And my memory of those Romanian studies is that these children, they weren't even sort of hugged or cared for, and that was in part an explanation about why they were so troubled.
Yeah, that's part of the story of American behaviorism, Skinner, you know, and Watson. They had this idea that children should not be hugged and cuddled and kissed. Children should be just rewarded and punished whenever that was necessary. And that has been applied in orphanages, like in Romania, and that's the result that you get is total emotional disturbance.
Yeah, marasmus, failure to thrive. Yeah. You write that we have tended to, I guess, undervalue or not understand the intelligence in animals. I haven't really put together the kinds of tests that would tell us just how smart an elephant is or a primate is. And you went to the National Zoo, and there's an elephant that you saw, Kandula, a young bull elephant. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, so we always assume that these animals can do things that we can do. And so with the elephants, they had tested tool use with elephants by putting some food outside of their area and give them a few sticks and say, are they going to use the sticks to get the food? A chimpanzee would immediately do that, would not hesitate to do that. But the elephants never used any sticks. And so the conclusion then was the elephants don't know how to use tools. And that's very often. We do the wrong test on animals and we have negative evidence, and then we say, well, they miss a capacity which is essential for us, but they don't have it. And then one day the investigators, they tested the elephants very differently. So they hung some food very high up, and they gave the elephants boxes. And immediately they started using this stuff. They moved the boxes underneath the food, and they would stand on the box, and then they could reach with their trunk to food. And the thing with elephants is that their trunk is their smelling organ, and so picking up a stick is not something they like to do because they shut off the smelling organ. Increasingly, we are now doing tests, and we're increasingly successful with this, tests that really apply to the animal, that take the animal into account. For example, chimpanzees were tested on face recognition by presenting them human faces, and they were doing very poorly on it. And I talked with the investigators who did it, and they said, well, of course, human faces are the most distinct faces. If they cannot recognize those, they cannot recognize anything else. But when we tested them systematically with chimp faces, they were doing perfectly well on it. And so that's often we have these anthropocentric assumptions which stand in the way of getting at the intelligence of the animals.
How human-centric of us.
Yeah.
And that was my conversation with primatologist Frans de Waal, recorded in 2013. He joined me to discuss his book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among Primates. And that wraps up the springtime edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Thanks for listening.